Bull wasn't sure how to respond. But before she had the opportunity to, a stern voice behind her made them both jump.
"Nurse Granger, may I have a word, please?"
Mrs. Baker squeezed Nicole's hand, in anticipation of what was to come, and Nicole followed Matron into an office. The only thing to separate Matron from the nursing characters Hattie Jakes portrayed in the Carry On films was her modern-day uniform, thought Nicole. During working hours, Matron discouraged fraternization between staff and patients. Her old-school approach bore little relationship with modern nursing methods.
"May I remind you, once again, there are more patients in this ward than Mrs. Bloody Baker," Matron snapped. "Just because her husband was on the trust board, so she gets her own room, does not mean she can expect preferential treatment over everyone else. Do I make myself clear?"
Nicole swallowed hard.
"Yes, Matron. Now, start your rounds and visit this woman in your own time, or you'll be on report. Again."
Nicole followed her out of the office, and if Matron had turned around a second earlier, she'd have seen Nicole giving her the finger behind her back. "Today."
"A nurse, eh?"
began Tommy, his eyes lighting up.
"Does that mean you get to wear one of those sexy uniforms?"
"Yes, that's right," sighed Nicole. "We all skip around in high heels, fishnet tights and miniskirts with our shirts buttoned so you can see our bras. Every now and then we'll pull a stethoscope out from between our boobs." Tommy was instantly embarrassed by the immaturity of his question, but amused by her response.
"How long are you in L.A. for?"
Nicole asked, changing the subject.
"As long as it takes to figure out what I want to do with my life."
"And what do you want to do, Tommy? You know, in an ideal world?"
"Right now, I'll give you three guesses,"
he replied with a flirty smile.
"I know what I want too,"
whispered Nicole, and smiled, pulling Tommy's bandaged hand closer to her chest. He felt his heart beat faster, and he swallowed hard.
"And what's that? I want another beer. Now be a good boy and go get me one."
In the 10 minutes Nicole and Tommy had spent in the kitchen, they'd failed to realize they were not alone until a gentle snoring caught their attention. They turned together to see Joe, sitting on a stool in the corner of the room and slumped fast asleep across a work surface next to two large steaming pots. Tommy examined the pot's contents. One contained an almost solid, rust-coloured mass of sauce, and the other was crammed with charred spaghetti and no water.
"Joe, wake up!"
yelled Tommy. Joe's eyes shot open, and he was clearly unsure of his surroundings.
"Mate, you've cremated the pasta! There's a room full of hungry people waiting for this."
"Sorry. Just busy, forgot."
Tommy helped Joe back to his dormitory, removed his baseball cap and put him to bed. As he left, he was startled by Ruth's presence, sitting on the top of a bunk bed and viewing something on her iPad. One headphone was plugged into her ear, and the other dangled by her shoulder.
"Hello,"
Tommy began, and Ruth gave an awkward, tight-lipped smile.
"It's Ruth, right? I checked you in. I've not seen you about much."
Ruth continued smiling, but didn't reply.
"Are you coming downstairs to the party? There's free beer."
Ruth shook her head.
"Not much of a drinker."
Ruth shook her head again.
"Or talker."
By the time Ruth plucked the teeth-whitening trays from her mouth, Tommy had given up on the conversation and left her with only the sounds of the party a floor below to keep her company. Chapter 12. Wanting, needing, waiting for you to justify my love, came Madonna's breathy vocals over the trip-hop drum loop as the song's heavy bass boomed from the speakers above the stage. The punters watched in silence as the dancer began her slow, sensual descent down the pole and towards the rubber-matted floor. She held on with a baseball-style grip, swung her outside leg into a hook, and picked up her inside leg, which followed suit. She threw her head and shoulders back to accentuate her breasts, and pouted. Despite the track being older than her, she knew every word and every beat off by heart, as she danced to it twice per shift for the last 4 months. Before Savannah stumbled into a career as an exotic dancer, she had a preconceived notion strip clubs were sleazy dives patronized by paunchy middle-aged men, like she'd seen depicted in cable TV shows like The Sopranos. But both the decor and the clientele of Santa Monica's Pink Pussycat Club changed her mind. Open 24 hours a day and a 10-minute cab ride from Venice Beach, the spacious lounge area housed two stages and two poles on either side of the room, with a bar to separate them. White, clean leather armchairs and Chesterfield-style sofas surrounded the stages, and there were lamps with purple shades balanced on dark wooden tables. Smaller corner booths were roped off and reserved for VIP guests or parties who spent their dollars freely. Savannah had no desire to work at that strip club, or any strip club for that matter, but compared to the first place she'd danced at days after arriving in the City of Angels, this was like a palace, and offered her the security she needed. She could also bank up to $500 on a busy night, more than Dunkin' Donuts or Wendy's paid in a week. But in order to do the job, Savannah had imposed upon herself a moral code. Totally nude dances, private backstage lap dances, and dating the clientele were all strict no-nos. There were surefire ways of doubling her daily income, and while she didn't judge the other girls who took that route, she feared losing even more of herself than she had already. So no matter how much money was thrown on the table or slipped into her bra, she would not budge. The furthest she would stretch to were topless dances and peep show performances, involving her surrounded by customers in private booths, pleasuring themselves behind two-way mirrors. As Justify My Love gradually faded out, she scooped up her tips and made her way back towards the changing room, where she stared into an illuminated mirror. She wiped the perspiration from her forehead and underarms, removed her smoky eye makeup with a damp tissue, then reached into her handbag for her mascara, and found an embossed business card Tommy had given her 2 days earlier.
"Some bloke came in here looking for you," he'd informed her. "He didn't give me a name, but he was an intimidating bastard. Had two big guys with him. He gave me his card, but I didn't tell him you lived here."
Savannah had forced herself to sound calm as she took the card, then raced up the stairs and into her room. Inside, she'd shut and locked the door, made for the bathroom, and vomited into the toilet bowl. The card only contained a number that she didn't recognize, but that worried her. She knew being afraid of the unknown was worse than being afraid of the expected, so she took her phone from her handbag, changed the settings so her number remained anonymous, and nervously dialed. Seven months earlier, Montgomery, Alabama.
"Be gone, devil! With the spirit of Jesus in me, I'm ordering you to leave this child's body and make her clean again."
The audience was transfixed by Reverend Devereaux in anticipation of the miracle they had queued much of the morning to witness. With the exception of scattered amens yelled by pockets of onlookers, the only voices to be heard through the arena speakers were those belonging to the Reverend and his male assistants, muttering their approval at what was to come. The Reverend allowed the tension to build gradually before he cupped the chin of the child who stood trembling before him. He placed the palm of his other hand on her forehead and clasped it so tightly it left the impression of his gold sovereign ring on her ochre skin.
"Speak, child, speak," he yelled.
The temperature from the bulbs in the lighting ring above made sweat trickle down his forehead and drip from the microphone fastened from cheek to ear.
"Speak to me! Speak to your people! Speak to us all!"
The girl's head continued to quiver as he gripped her face.
"Tell everyone how Jesus has saved you!"
he bellowed.
"She began.
She looked into the Reverend's narrowed eyes and then finally parted her lips.
"Jesus has saved me,"
she blurted out.
"Louder,"
he repeated, specks of saliva landing on her cheek.
"Say it louder." "Jesus has saved me,"
she repeated, her voice rising to a more confident yell.
"Jesus has saved me."
The audience rose to its feet, applauding and roaring its approval as the 15-strong brass band on the lowest tier of the stage launched into When the Saints Go Marching In. Reverend Devereaux had already left the girl to his assistant's devices. The assistant hurried her from the stage and into the wings and away from the audience before her stammer returned. They'd learned from mistakes made years earlier about how quickly miracles wore off once adrenaline levels subsided. Reverend Devereaux took to the centre of his stage, outstretched his arms like he was attached to an invisible crucifix, and nodded to the audience. Indoor fireworks exploded behind him as the encouraging noises continued, before he waited patiently for the crowd to quieten. The television cameras focused close enough to capture the broken capillary veins scattered across his cheeks and nose, beaming his image across the amphitheatre on a huge screen.
"Today," he began in hushed tones, "Jesus made a crippled woman walk again. He aided a boy born without eardrums to hear for the first time in his life, and he removed cataracts from the eyes of a blind grandmother. This is what happens when, not if, you allow the power of Jesus into your life. And for the benefits of our friends at home, just think what you could accomplish if you let him into your life, too. You can do that right now by picking up your telephone, calling the number at the bottom of your screen. It doesn't matter how much you donate, but the more you can afford, the more people we can help. Galatians 6:10 said, 'Let us do good to everyone, and especially to those who are of the household of faith.' Thank you, my friends, and may God's love be with you."
Reverend Devereaux bowed to his audience as they hollered, whistled, and applauded, and in return he clapped them and his stage helpers before leaving the podium. There was only one person in the arena who failed to arise and show her appreciation of the miracles that afternoon had witnessed, and Reverend Devereaux was fully aware of this. He would have stern words with her later, but Savannah Devereaux had no intention of obeying her father. Today. Savannah's hand trembled as she held the phone to her ear. After 3 rings, the call was answered, but nobody spoke. The stalemate lasted for several seconds before the door behind Savannah opened and Roxy walked in.
"Hey, Savannah. I thought you'd gone,"
she yelled before Savannah could hang up. She breathed quickly and wondered if her call had just opened Pandora's box. Chapter 13. The pan of water was too large and too heavy for one person to lift alone, especially with a wounded hand. But Tommy attempted it anyway. When it was clear his bravado was bordering on embarrassing, Nicole stepped in to help before he poured it across the floor.
"Thanks," Tommy mumbled. "It's my first night in Los Angeles and you've got me chained to the kitchen sink. This doesn't bode well for our relationship."
"Well, I can make pasta for one, not for 60. Certainly not me own."
"So you think all women automatically know how to cook? That's a bit sexist of you."
"Oh, no, I don't mean it like that.
I'm just teasing,"
Nicole replied, scraping burned pasta from Joe's pan with a wooden spoon.
"So, how did you end up here?"
"You were with me. Joe was ruining the dinner."
"Oh, Lord,"
sighed Nicole.
"I meant, how did you end up in L.A.?"
"Oh, right, sorry," Tommy replied. "Well, I could tell you, but it's not exactly a barrel of laughs."
Nicole held her spoon over the sink.
"Do you want to do this on your own?"
She smiled. 2 years earlier, Northampton, England.
"Do you ever turn that damn thing off?"
Lee glared at Tommy's reflection in the rearview mirror as he drove. Tommy chose to ignore him and continued to pan the lens of his digital camcorder around the Mini.
Were you even filming?
Nothing much, just you two. And wherever we go past, it looks interesting, replied Tommy,
as the trees outside began to thin and make way for a succession of residential houses and shops.
I need a backdrop for this project I'm working on.
Being round you's like living in the Big Brother house,
continued Lee. Cameras constantly following you about. Daniel interrupted from the passenger seat.
That new Arctic Monkeys album's out soon. I hope it's better than the last one.
Do you want to hear it? It leaked early, so I downloaded it last night, said Tommy enthusiastically.
He removed his iPhone from the back pocket of his chinos and scrolled through his playlists, while his video camera continued to record.
You should try surfing the Russian websites like I do. There's so much illegal pre-release stuff online if you know where to look.
Yeah, I've heard some of the Russian websites you surf when you think everyone else is asleep.
Lee smirked.
Oh, yes,
teased Daniel.
Even Mum says she's heard your bed squeaking to the sound of online Russian girls groaning in your bedroom for 70 rubles a minute. You are such a liar,
Tommy snapped as his face reddened. Daniel and Lee enjoyed embarrassing their younger sibling, knowing that anything to do with the opposite sex would have the desired effect. Despite the 2.5-year gap separating the twins from Tommy and the fact that Daniel and Lee were in their final few weeks of university, they had remained a close family. The car slowed down as it reached traffic lights, and Tommy continued to hunt through his extensive collection of downloaded music.
When you're done at your lectures, can you pick me up from Sean's house?
He asked. You can catch the bus back. We're going out of our way as it is to give you a lift there, replied Lee dismissively.
That's not fair. Mum and Dad bought you a car while I have to cycle everywhere like a paper boy.
And I'll buy you one too if you get into uni. But you're the one who took a gap year and then did sod all with it, continued Lee. You need to get your arse into gear, start looking at courses and get your applications in.
Well, I still need a bit of time to decide what I want to do,
Tommy replied, bored of being lectured by his parents and his brothers.
Don't tell Dad that, or you'll be in Afghanistan before you know it, added Daniel.
If it's film school you really want to get into, then he'll come around eventually. Just make a decision and go with it. Stop wasting time.
Okay, okay, enough of the pep talk.
Tommy knew full well that at 19 he needed to get his act together. Sean aside, most of his friends were finishing their first year at university while he'd floundered, working part-time on a checkout in Tesco. With his brother's sponsored university places coming to an end, they'd be trainee Marines by Christmas, but Tommy had no interest in the family tradition of joining the armed forces. Instead, he preferred to be holed up in his darkened bedroom, making mini-movies and editing them on his laptop. His focus was often on landscapes, inner city, coastal and countryside, and exploring new ways of filming them, but with only a handheld digital camcorder he'd bought himself with his supermarket earnings, his ability to develop his skill was limited. He barely went anywhere without it, constantly uploading clips to YouTube, in the faint hope a famous director would see his potential and invite him to work as a trainee cinematographer on the set of a movie. But Martin Scorsese had yet to spot his potential.
Plug this in,
Tommy said, handing Lee his iPhone. As the green traffic light turned red and the Mini accelerated across a junction, Tommy lost his grip of the phone and it bounced off Lee's thigh and into the driver's footwell.
Tommy, you dick,
barked Lee, unclipping his seatbelt to fumble around for the phone. For a split second, Tommy noticed a dark shadow through the lens of his camcorder, but it moved too quickly for his eyes to process what it was. Suddenly the brother's world became deafeningly loud and turned to black as the shadow ploughed into the side of their car, forcing it to roll over twice before it settled on its side. Today.
I've been looking for you,
barked Eric, interrupting Tommy's recounting of his past and Nicole's gradual understanding of the vulnerability of the boy standing before her in the kitchen.
Sorry, it's my fault. I asked for Nicole's help, replied Tommy.
Could I have a word, Nick? Eric glared.
Sure?
In private. Nicole followed Eric from the kitchen and down the corridor before he came to a halt. The smell of beer remained on his skin.
I've been standing downstairs like an idiot waiting for you, but surprise, surprise, you're up here with him.
He began heatedly.
What's your problem with Tommy?
Nicole replied, startled by his outburst.
I don't have a problem with Tommy,
Eric continued, trying to control his frustration. What I do have a problem with is being left alone while you make a fool of yourself.
Jesus, Eric, I'm getting sick of your mood swings today.
I don't trust him. He's probably tried it on with every girl here.
He's not like that. And what business would it be of yours if he had? I can look after myself.
Yeah, you did a great job with Pete, didn't you? Nicole scowled at Eric, angry that he would bring up such a painful memory to use against her.
That's not fair,
she replied quietly, as Eric instantly regretted his choice of ammunition. He softened his tone accordingly. I'm sorry, that wasn't fair. But I'm your best friend, Nick, and if it weren't for me, you wouldn't have even known Pete was screwing around on you. I'm a good judge of character, so trust me on this. Tommy's no good. I'm a bloke. We know this kind of thing. Nicole said nothing, and her eyes sank to the floor.
Look, we're here for a reason, he continued. Maybe thousands of pounds worth of reasons. All I'm saying is, don't let some kid you hardly know get in the way of that. Now come here.
Eric put his arms around Nicole and kissed her on the cheek. She always felt safe when she was with Eric, even when he was thoughtless, but she was reluctant to believe Tommy had any agenda. He was right when he told her about travellers wanting to share their lives with others in short spaces of time. But it wasn't something she could reciprocate.
"Let me help him out with dinner. I promise I'll be down in 15 minutes,
Nicole conceded. Eric nodded his approval, and Nicole headed back into the kitchen.
"Everything okay?"
asked Tommy chirpily.
"Yes, it's fine,"
replied Nicole, and said very little else during the rest of their 15 minutes together. Chapter 14 Day 2 Matty and Declan left the cooling ocean water in just their underwear and made for the towels they'd left spread across Venice's sandy beach.
"I can see your little fella,"
began Matty, pointing to Declan's boxers, the water having made them transparent.
"Less of the lil,"
Declan replied and rubbed his hair with his towel.
"It was feckin' cold in there."
Their walk from Santa Monica via Venice Beach Boulevard in the blistering heat had been exhausting, especially with two bulging rucksacks strapped to their backs. So their brief respite in the ocean had been a welcome diversion. Despite not having stepped inside a gym for the best part of a year, Declan was grateful good genetics meant his chest and arms retained their muscular shape. He'd used the last squirt of sunblock earlier that morning, and with each passing hour, he felt his milky Irish skin reddening further.
"I'll kill you if they're fully booked, after days on that stinking feckin' thing,"
warned Matty, and he took a swig of water.
"It was your idea to save money and go freight train hopping. You're supposed to be the sensible one and talk me out of crap like that. Besides, we could have managed a Holiday Inn if you hadn't blown our money in Reno, trying to be Billy Big Bollocks in front of the showgirls. Where else am I going to find a bird with firm breasts and feathers stuck to her arse?"
"The hen house?"
Their arrival in Los Angeles early that morning was the culmination of a 5-day expedition riding the railways from Seattle to Idaho, then the length of Nevada, cross-country to Utah, before finally reaching L.A. Although strictly illegal, freight train hopping was the cheapest way to travel long distances and witness parts of America that couldn't be negotiated by car or bus. An article in a Reader's Digest magazine Matty found in a hospital waiting room in Florida gave him the inspiration to trek by boxcar. The written recollections of former rail riders got him wondering what it must have been like to travel the country in search of new jobs and new beginnings during America's Great Depression. In reality, it had proved an ordeal, and much more precarious than his naive imagination had anticipated. The first hurdle was finding freight yards where trains and their boxcars passed through or were parked up. Then, once a slowed-down train was in sight, they had to run to keep up with it, promptly pick a carriage with an open door, then hurl themselves and their luggage into it. Twice they'd failed, and had been forced to wait 10 hours for the next train to pass. Once inside, their final hurdle was to stay alive, because manoeuvring around a fast-moving carriage was awkward and clumsy, and would regularly result in them being hurled around like wrestlers in a ring. The sound of the grinding wheels on the steel tracks was often so deafening, they'd insert their in-ear headphones to nullify the noise. The nights were cold, and the carriages stank of the product being transported. For 2 of their 6 journeys, they'd picked the wrong boxcars, and slept on bags of fertilizer and boxes of bottled bleach. Another was spent in an open carriage, zipped up head to toe in sleeping bags to protect them from the 60 miles per hour winds. Only their last journey was more pleasant, tucked up amongst crate after crate of mattresses, computer games consoles, and Blu-ray players. Matty and Declan learned to avoid other freight train hoppers. Often they were nomadic souls, unwilling to have their space invaded, or were suffering addictions to narcotics or alcohol and wanted to rob you at knife point. Matty noted the magazine story failed to mention any of those perils. Only once, during a routine check at a station in Utah, had an armed security guard discovered them. But experience had taught them they could get away with a lot if they exaggerated their accents and asked Americans if they had any Irish in their heritage. Invariably, their interrogator would say yes, and claim to be 1/10 Gaelic, to which Matty and Declan would respond that they'd known immediately. Then they'd be left alone to go about their business by their flattered and gullible distant compatriot. But as uncomfortable and anxious as they'd often felt, it had been the journey of a lifetime, and they'd seen more of America than most of its natives. Once they finally reached L.A., and reeking of train grease and body odor, they made their way to the coast and charged straight into the ocean to clean up. As they walked along the beachfront, Declan removed his T-shirt, dousing it with water from a bottle attached to his belt and wrapping it around his head. Meanwhile, Matty's sweat-sodden shirt clung to his skinny body, and he felt one of the blisters on his heels burst and weep inside his dirty white Converse trainers. The straps of his rucksack dug into his bony shoulders and chafed his skin.
"Hold up! This is the place," said Matty suddenly, pointing to the dilapidated building ahead of them.
"Here we go,"
Declan replied, staring at the faded sign reading Venice Beach International Hotel.
"Another shithole we can't afford."
"But we always find a way, don't we?"
replied Matty, patting his rucksack and grinning.
"And this time, we have a secret weapon."
Chapter 15. In the 217 days since Tommy and Sean's plane taxied towards its stand at New York's JFK Airport, much of the £8,000 Tommy had carefully scrimped and saved had been spent on travel, accommodation, food, and alcohol. Now, with a depleted bank balance and mounting credit card bill, he was a beggar who couldn't afford not to choose the hostel jobs manager Ron threw at him. So he worked 8-hour days across a variety of tasks, from cleaning to cash and carry food shopping, to pay for his bed and board. For the rest of the morning, until Sadie took over, Tommy was on rota to cover the reception desk. Bored and with no one to talk to, he fiddled with the aerial on the television set to get a sharper picture, then resisted the temptation to peek under his bandage to see how his cut hand was healing. He grabbed a pile of magazines and stacked them on a shelf, color-coordinating their spines. He picked out a couple of roll-up cigarette butts from the always-close-to-death-but-never-quite-there yucca plant, and sniffed them. He recognized their familiar cannabis scent before flicking them in the bin. While smoking dope was commonplace in the dorms and on the roof, it was an activity he was wary of. He thought back to the conversation he'd begun the previous night with Nicole. The only person on his travels he'd ever told about the car accident that changed the course of his life. And even then he hadn't explained to her the complete story, because that was a can of worms best left unopened. So, in retrospect, he was glad Eric had interrupted them, even if Nicole's mood had shifted somewhat on her return.
"Tommy!"
yelled Sadie's voice from upstairs in the lounge. He recognized her distinctive, bossy New York twang immediately, and wondered why, even though he was her equal on the reception desk, she appeared to believe he was her employee.
"Get your ass up here!"
"What's up?" he replied, narrowing his eyes.
"Now!"
Tommy took the stairs two at a time, and when he reached the lounge, he offered a puzzled frown before launching into peals of laughter. Chapter 16 "I'm not sure I really get it," began Eric, removing his shades and turning 180 degrees to gain a better view of Venice Beach Boardwalk and its colourful residents.
"What's not to get?"
asked Nicole.
"I just don't get the appeal. Or why the guidebooks say it's so special. Reminds me of Blackpool, but with a better beach."
Confused by his indifference, Nicole's patience wore thin and she put her hands on her hips.
"You have got to be kidding me."
She and Eric followed the route Tommy had taken her a day earlier, before kicking off their flip-flops and making their way across the warm, sparkling sand. The beach was quiet, apart from a few families eating picnics close to the ocean's waves. In the distance, they could barely make out Santa Monica Pier as the sun hid behind clouds of smog. But 100 meters out to sea, brightly coloured sails bobbed up and down as windsurfing boards glided across the water's surface. Eric removed his everyday rucksack, took out 2 bottles of Sprite, and placed them on either end of a weathered road map to stop the light breeze from carrying it away. Nicole flicked through the dog-eared pages of an atlas, skipping past pages of towns leading off Route 66 they'd circled in red.
"So we went where we thought we were supposed to go," began Nicole, "and that was following Route 66 from where it starts in Illinois and ends in Santa Monica."
"I was there, Nick. I can remember this."
"I know. I'm just saying it out loud to get it clear in my head. Somewhere en route, we missed what we were looking for, so our options are this. Reread her letter, take a closer look at each town on the internet, or completely retrace our steps." "Are you kidding me? It's a miracle that truck has made it 3,000 miles. There's no way in hell I'm doing that journey again." "I don't think we need to. I have a feeling we're in the right neck of the woods, give or take a few 100 miles.
"And do you have any thoughts as to what we're going to find when we get there?" Nicole shook her head.
"Not a bloody clue."
11 weeks earlier, London. Nicole fanned herself with her hand as the digital clock on the TV above Mrs. Baker's bed hit 2100 hours.
"It's a bit hot in here, isn't it?"
Nicole asked, and went back to painting Mrs. Baker's fingernails. Her shift had ended an hour earlier, but Nicole wanted to find a way of cheering up her patient and friend. Mrs. Baker's nails were grey like her skin, so Nicole added French tips and painted them a deep red. She smiled at her handiwork and wondered if she should have stuck with her original post-A-levels plan and trained as a beauty therapist instead of a nurse. Mrs. Baker was sitting upright for the first time in days, albeit awkwardly, and with pillows supporting her aching back and neck.
"Before Joseph opened the jewellers, we spent the first 18 months of married life backpacking around the world,"
she recalled.
"India, South Africa, Australia and America. It was quite a wild thing to do back then when everyone else our age was settling down and having babies."
"That sounds incredible," said Nicole.
"Oh, it was, dear. Joseph and I travelled Route 66 in 1971. We bought a brand new pickup truck in New York and started from the road's origins in Chicago and drove all the way over to California, visiting everywhere from big cities to ghost towns. The happiest night of my life was when we pushed the seats down and slept by the banks of a lake. The wind was cold. We had the heater on full and we just lay there listening to a cassette over and over again."
Nicole caught herself smiling, trying to imagine being there.
"A long, long time ago," Mrs. Baker began to sing quietly, I can still remember how the music used to make me smile. We stared at the stars, shining like diamonds.
I've never had the time or the money to travel, said Nicole.
I'm sure that will change one day. Do you mind me asking what made you become a nurse?
Well, I was 13 when my mum was diagnosed with breast cancer. For years she was in and out of hospitals, having tests and treatments and operations. And I'd see how hard the nurses worked to make her feel comfortable. And when she lost her battle 4 years later, I thought it'd keep a bit of her alive if I could help other people.
And now, because... And tell me if I'm speaking out of place, but you don't seem too happy with your lot.
Nicole sighed. Eric once nicknamed her cling film face because she was so transparent. And try as she might, she found it near impossible to disguise whatever it was she was feeling at that moment.
It's harder than I thought, Nicole admitted. I don't get along with Matron, I never have any money, and I've more bags than a Prada catalogue under my eyes. It's not the life I thought it'd be.
Mrs. Baker clasped Nicole's hand.
I hope you don't mind me saying, but I'm sure your mother would have been very proud of you. I know I would be if you were my daughter.
Nicole blushed. It had been 14 years since her mother had passed away. And although her father had appeared intermittently throughout her life, it had been a decade since their paths last crossed. She'd grown to understand she didn't need a relationship with a name on a birth certificate.
"Is there a young man in your life?"
continued Mrs. Baker.
"Someone to go home to and who cooks you dinner or massages your feet?"
"No, not since Pete,"
Nicole replied. And for the first time that week, his face appeared from the smoke in her memory. When confronted by the photos Eric had taken and WhatsApped her, Pete claimed the drunken girl had thrown herself at him, and the picture was taken from a deceptive angle. But she'd believed her best friend when he'd told her he'd seen them together at least twice before in the bar. Pete begged his childhood sweetheart to stay with him, and for a while Nicole remained. But, try as she might to convince herself it was just a bump in their well-travelled road, she knew she could never trust him again. Each night he spent out with the boys or working overtime at the estate agents or the after-hours texts he received made her doubt him. So with Eric's help, she packed her clothes and moved out of their terraced house and into a rented one-bedroom flat, leaving behind everything that Pete had tainted with his infidelity. At first, Nicole missed him terribly. Then, gradually, it was their future she missed, rather than the man himself. A small piece of her crumbled each time she walked past the hospital maternity unit and saw new parents tenderly cradling their babies, knowing she and Pete would never be like them. She'd imagined what it could have been like if she and Eric had ever stepped over the line, but, try as she might, she couldn't think of Eric in a sexual way. He'd always be like a brother to her. She once broached the subject of co-parenting a child with Eric in a roundabout, joking kind of way. But he seemed dismissive of the idea of being either a hands-on or hands-off father. And Nicole's only attempt at a date in the last 12 months had ended when she walked out of the cafe after his first words, "Now here's a girl who likes her food." So Nicole vowed if she hadn't found Mr. Wright by 35, she would go it alone and explore artificial insemination. While Eric wasn't willing to supply his sperm, he did supply her with company, nights out and a shoulder to cry on. And not once had he attempted to take advantage of her vulnerability.
"I thought maybe you were courting that young man outside,"
Mrs. Baker continued.
"My ears can't hear speaking voices very well from a distance any more, but I often hear you two giggling together."
"No, he's my best friend, but he's not my type."
"But I bet if I ever met him and asked him the same question, he'd answer differently,"
smiled Mrs. Baker.
"And who could blame him? You're a pretty, intelligent girl with an enormous heart. Any man would be mad not to snap you up."
A deliberate cough from the doorway interrupted their heart-to-heart. Both turned their heads to see an immaculately dressed woman with a pashmina draped over the shoulders of a cream Burberry suit.
"Hello, Mother,"
said the woman coldly, and entered the room, slipping off her jacket and passing it to Nicole without making eye contact.
"Find somewhere for this, then close the door."
"Did you take a wrong turn getting here, Bridget?"
asked Mrs. Barker.
"No, why?"
"Because I've been here almost a fortnight, and you've yet to make an appearance. I presumed you'd got lost in the car park."
Nicole felt uncomfortable as the once pleasant atmosphere iced over, and Bridget glared at her. Nicole stood up and moved awkwardly towards the door.
"I'll see you tomorrow, Mrs. Baker,"
she smiled, then closed the door behind her, dropping Bridget's jacket to the floor on her way out. Chapter 17 Today. Tommy couldn't stop laughing at the sight of Paik's head hanging upside down from a jagged hole in the ceiling tile.
"Right, now's the time to tell me what you're doing, or I'm leaving you hanging," Tommy began.
"I told you before, I'm doing something for Ron."
"So Ron's asked you to fall through every ceiling in his building, has he?"
"Are you going to help me down or not?"
Paik replied crossly. Two joints fell from his shirt pocket to the floor below.
"Well, if you stop smoking that crap, you might keep your balance."
"And if you start smoking this crap, you might chill out and get laid."
Tommy smiled, shook his head and waved goodbye to Paik and Sadie. He headed back to reception, with the sound of Paik's Dutch obscenities following him down the corridor. They could still be heard when he reached the top of the stairs and spotted Joe's unkempt pal Wayne entering the building, with a mangy dog wearing a rope for a collar.
"Hey, I've told you before, get out,"
ordered Tommy, and without protest, Wayne turned around and shuffled away sheepishly. However, his dog had its own agenda, and suddenly bolted past them both and into the hostel. Tommy chased after him up into the kitchen, where he found it hovering by Ruth's feet, its head bowed, eagerly licking her ankles. A delighted Ruth scratched behind his ear, enjoying the attention from the four-legged stranger. Five weeks earlier, Dog Sanctuary, Victoria, Australia.
"Uh-oh. You know who's on his way over here,"
warned Colleen and straightened her back as she swept the floor.
"Who?"
asked Ruth, placing her dirty mop in the plastic bucket. She wiped the sweat from her brow with her shirt sleeve.
"As if you have to ask," chuckled Colleen. "Your bloody shadow. Who else? Whenever you're here, you know he's never going to be that far behind. We work with enough dogs to know when one's on heat."
Ruth felt her face redden as a smiling Mickey walked towards her. Dogs leapt as high as their hind legs would allow in their gaited pounds, and poked their snouts through the metal bars when he passed. What Mickey lacked in his 5'5" stature and unremarkable looks, he made up for with persistence and optimism. The three eager strays on the end of their leads strained as they approached Colleen and Ruth, desperate for their attention.
"And what can we do you for?"
began Colleen, knowing full well what or who had brought him over.
"Well, I've come to say this, beaut,"
Mickey began, his big beaming smile revealing a less than proportionate tooth-to-gum ratio.
"I thought you might have. Don't distract her for long. We've got another 12 pounds to scrub before it's clocking off time."
"So how's about it, then?" Mickey directed at Ruth.
"How's about what?"
she replied shyly.
"The same it Mickey asks you every time," interrupted Colleen. "Oh, that."
"Every week I ask you out for some tucker. Every week you tell me you're busy. Come on, Ruthie. Does a bloke have to go down on his hands and knees in dog shit and beg?"
At 24, Ruth had yet to accept a date invitation from Mickey, or from any man, for that matter. When she'd relayed to her mother Mickey's interest some months earlier, Denise trawled through his Facebook profile and offhandedly advised her daughter,
"Neither of you are in a position to be picky."
Ruth was sure Mickey would make some girl very, very happy, at least at the beginning, because eventually he would leave that girl and break her heart, as that's what all men were programmed to do to women. Her mother had reminded her of that enough times over the years. Even her brother Kevin took pride in showing Ruth the begging texts he'd received from girls he'd duped, slept with, and then dumped. And she'd watched enough movies and soap operas to know that relationships rarely worked out like they were supposed to. Men would say all the things you wanted to hear, but in the end they'd replace you with someone else once they grew tired of you. Ruth wouldn't allow Mickey to do that to her. There was only one man she was certain would love her as much as she loved him. Zack Stanley's lips would be the first and only pair she would ever have pressed against hers.
"Thanks, but I can't,"
Ruth told Mickey assertively, then paused.
"I'm seeing someone."
Mickey and Colleen looked at each other, then at Ruth.
"Really?"
they replied together.
"You don't know him,"
replied Ruth, preempting their next question. She picked up her bucket and walked towards a drain to empty the dirty water.
"I'm going to check on Bobby."
"Maybe if I had four legs and licked my own balls, she'd be interested," mumbled Mickey sulkily before wandering off,
while Colleen pondered who on earth Ruth could have fallen for so quietly. The groggy border terrier lay on a soft fleece blanket in his cage, slowly regaining consciousness. His black, dimpled nose twitched when he smelt Ruth's familiar bleachy scent as she entered the recovery room. A gauze bandage was wrapped around his front left leg, and an IV drip stretched to a bag attached to the front of his cage. Ruth carefully opened the latch on the cage door and put her hand inside to stroke his wiry black head. He nuzzled Ruth's palm before closing his brown eyes and drifting back to sleep. Ruth's favourite of all the centre's unwanted dogs had resided there for a month after his neighbours reported him for howling at all hours in his garden. When the RSPCA arrived, officers discovered him sheltering from the rain under a rotting wooden door propped up against a shed. When the officer finally persuaded the shivering creature to trust her and exit his makeshift sanctuary, his matted body was covered in flea bites, stale blood, and his siblings' teeth marks. Ruth knew how it felt to be bullied in your own home, so she'd visit him 3 times a day, every day of the week, just to remind him not every human was cruel.
"Don't get too attached, Ruth,"
began Mr. Rogers. She jumped at hearing the voice of the dog pound's practice manager.
"If the antibiotics don't start working soon, we'll be wasting our time and money. You know what that means."
Ruth had watched Colleen wheel enough blanket-covered bodies towards the incinerator to know exactly what Mr. Rogers meant.
"No, no, no, we are not keeping that thing,"
Denise began, folding her arms defiantly. Ruth stood before her mother, cradling a bewildered Bobby in her arms. 1 hour and 2 bus journeys earlier, he'd been enjoying his post-anesthetic dreams about a nugget of chicken he'd found on a lawn. Now he could sense the animosity coming from the aggressive human in front of him.
"That wretched thing is not coming into this house,"
continued Denise.
"Which one?" added Kevin, much to his own and his mother's amusement.
"Please, Mum, they were going to destroy him,"
Ruth pleaded.
"You'll be no trouble, will you, Bobby? Look, he can't even walk properly."
To demonstrate Bobby's disability, Ruth placed him gently on the grass, where he sat down and took in his new surroundings. Then, quick as a flash, he was up on all fours and charged out of the garden. By the time Ruth reached the road, she'd already heard the thud of the car bumper colliding with him. The first shovel of dirt fell into the hole and covered Bobby's body. Ruth continued digging as her family looked on from their seats on the patio.
"That thing's going to stink in this heat,"
murmured Denise, as she took a long sip of her Long Island iced tea.
"Which one?"
replied Kevin. And he laughed as Ruth continued to dig. Chapter 18. Today. On those lazy mornings when his parents were out, and Tommy promised them he'd spend his time wisely by job hunting, he instead spent many an hour lying on the sofa with a TV remote control glued to his fingers, flicking through hundreds of Sky channels, overtly charming presenters desperately flogging ostentatious must-have watches and clothes that went up to size XXXXL amused him the most. But he'd never lingered on the religious channels until he arrived in L.A. Now he'd become fascinated by their broadcasts on the reception desk television. He puzzled at how people could be so daft and hand their money over so readily to preachers who claimed to be carrying out God's work when they were blatantly serving their own financial agenda. Today's focus of attention was an evangelist by the name of Reverend Devereux, a peculiar but amusing-looking man whose bark sounded worse than his bite. Tommy leaned back on his chair, flicking peanut butter M&M sweets into the air and catching them in his mouth. Most bounced off his lips or nose before he finally succeeded.
"You beauty!"
he cried proudly.
"Thank you,"
replied Savannah, watching him from the doorway. Surprised, Tommy fell from his seat and quickly scrambled back to his feet, to Savannah's amusement.
"Quiet afternoon," she continued.
"It's dead. How's yours?"
"Dull. Apart from a few Bunker Hill financiers putting money in my bra instead of in their kids' college fund. Am I still sleeping alone?"
"Yep, room's all yours."
Savannah leaned over the counter and gave him a peck on the cheek. She felt comfortable and unthreatened by Tommy. They'd talk with ease about how they'd just spent their day, but they never went into detail about their past and what brought them to their crossroads. Sometimes when Savannah returned from work in the early hours and Tommy was working a shift, they'd keep each other company watching old black-and-white films before she'd invariably fall asleep on his shoulder. Neither enjoyed spending time alone, and neither told the other why. On several occasions, Savannah considered admitting that on the night of his arrival, she'd been the one who came within two book chapters of blowing a hole through Tommy's spine. But then she would have felt obliged to reveal why she had a gun, and what she was really hiding from in Los Angeles, and they were secrets she'd only shared with one other person under that roof. So she decided against unburdening herself, as it would likely damage their friendship and serve no purpose to either of them.
"It's normally $10 for a peck," she smiled.
"You take an IOU?"
"For you, yes. But don't tell your girlfriend." "Nicole's not my girlfriend. I've not even seen her today." "Not yet," smiled Savannah.
Her light mood abruptly changed when she recognized a familiar voice preaching about sinners and Satan coming from the television.
"Why are you watching this?"
she snapped.
"Rev Dev's a funny guy. Why? Have you seen him before?"
Savannah's eyes narrowed.
"He's not a funny guy. He's a dangerous, sadistic son of a bitch."
7 months earlier, Montgomery, Alabama.
"Wipe this black stink off me,"
Reverend Devereux roared at a teenage boy. The terrified lad grabbed two white cotton-faced towels from the table in the Reverend's dressing room and began to dab at his employer's clothes. Meanwhile, the Reverend took a handful of wet wipes from a packet and rubbed his jowls and hands.
"Why'd you allow them on stage if you don't like touching them?"
asked Pastor Jackson, flicking the scroll wheel of his BlackBerry and checking his employer's emails.
"'Cause the blacks are where the money's at,"
the Reverend replied with disdain.
"All those Ella Mae Joneses sitting in front of their televisions in their ghetto swamps are praying for their drug-dealing sons to see the errors of their ways, and they ease their consciences about parental failure by donating money to my ministry. All those dollars add up. So if I have to touch their coal mine faces to convince them their dollars are worth my prayers, then so be it. But I don't have to like it. And I ain't going to have their smell on me a second longer than I need to."
I think you're very brave,
the Reverend's wife began and kissed his forehead. A small black curly afro hair fell from his shoulder and landed on the hem of her Diane von Furstenberg skirt. She brushed it to the carpet with the tip of her fingernail, then cleansed her hands using a pocket-sized bottle of antibacterial soap. Reverend Devereux took a swig from a bottle of chilled sparkling water, his eyes darting towards Savannah and her younger sister Rosanna, sitting quietly side by side on a plastic-covered sofa.
"Next week may I at least get a smile from my own flesh and blood?" he asked.
"I'm here, aren't I?"
Savannah replied, making little effort to disguise that she'd rather be anywhere else.
When one of the dozen television cameras pans across the audience to focus on my beloved family, I expect my viewers to see them caught up in the joy I'm bringing, he continued, and not sitting there turning their spoiled little noses up like skunks have crawled up their asses. Do you understand me?
Savannah and Rosanna nodded their heads.
Good. Now bring me joyful news from the world of ticket receipts, Pastor Jackson. Tell me how well we have done this evening.
His head of finances clicked on the latest email to reach his phone and smiled. Preliminary figures suggest around the $75,000 mark so far from the folks at home, and they are still counting donations from the collection plates, but with 12,000 seats sold, the arena was full to capacity, so that's going to be a lot of donations for the church.
Good, good,
smiled the Reverend and turned to his wife.
Looks like we'll get that estate by the lake just in time for summer after all.
I hate him. I absolutely hate him,
Savannah whispered. The heat from the Starbucks coffee mug began to burn her hands as she clasped it tightly, but she kept them in place. Physical pain helped to block out the animosity and frustration she felt each time she failed to stand up to her father. After each Sunday morning and Wednesday evening wasted at his weekly telecasts, Savannah spent the rest of the day nauseated by the genes she shared with a man who so eagerly misled the vulnerable. She felt a permanent unease for the folk who could barely afford to eat regularly, yet saved up their cash and spent $25 a ticket to witness one of his sermons in person. That afternoon, Savannah kept recalling the shy little black girl with the stammer, and the terror that spread across her face as the fat white man shouted at her and tried to withdraw imaginary demons from her young body. There was nothing demonic inside her. She was made of love and trust, and raised by caring parents who believed in their hearts they were doing what was best for her. The Reverend was not God's vessel on earth, like he claimed. He was a charlatan who profited from blind faith. Savannah wondered if she was the only audience member to have noticed the child peeing herself when Reverend Devereux gripped her face. She was convinced her father had seen it too and got a kick out of it. Then Savannah remembered later, backstage, passing the crippled woman who'd taken baby steps in front of the audience earlier that day. Moments later, and out of view, she was back in her wheelchair, praying for the pain in her knees to subside. Savannah often chastised herself for remaining under the Reverend's roof and accepting his soiled dollars. As a beneficiary, she felt complicit, and it sickened her.
"Baby, you just have to hold on for another year, and then we'll be able to get somewhere of our own,"
reassured Michael from his seat opposite her. He placed his hands upon hers.
"Let him pay for your college fees. Once you graduate, I'll put in for a transfer, and we can move to New York like we planned."
"It's not my dad who's paying for all this, is it, though?"
she reasoned.
"It's his congregation. It's the collection plate he robs so we can live in a 20-room mansion, so I can drive a Mercedes, go to dance classes, buy clothes, shoot guns at the rifle range, and have the best education those people's money can buy."
"But you'll make it up to those folk once you leave college," Michael continued. "Do some volunteer work. Work full-time for a charity. Whatever you need to do to earn yourself some good karma. And you're doing this for us, not just for yourself."
Savannah knew what Michael said made sense. If she were to storm out of the family home on principle to go it alone, he too would suffer from the loss of her generous allowance that helped to pay for his college tuition. Michael also abhorred his inability to pay his own way, but he knew he was benefiting for the greater good. I can't afford to put myself through med school on my own, or I'd be paying off